Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your host is humbled by the support of great listeners, including Bonnie Baker, Paul L. Sesser, Keita Tom in Oregon, and Michael Gill. And I want to thank the new faces who've popped up subscribing at peterbcollins.com. Your support keeps us going. In the second portion of this podcast, we're going to meet Nancy Talanian. She is the founder and executive director of No More Guantanamos. But first, we welcome back our absolute favorite spook, retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern. And he's got a new website up at RaymondMcGovern.com, where you can find the great articles and analytical pieces that he publishes. Ray, welcome back to the PBC show.
Thank you, Peter B. That's a dubious accolade there, favorite spook.
Well, you spooked the truth.
Oh, we're getting worser and worser.
Yeah, I better stop before it does get worse. Well, Ray, there are a number of things I want to talk with you about today, and I always appreciate your candor and the way you assess the situation in America today. And I invited you because on January 24th, you published a piece at consortiumnews.com that is about two things. It's about whether or not Iran poses an imminent threat to its neighbors and potentially the United States, and the coverage of that story. So let's start with the facts and let people know what the current state of play is regarding intelligence on the intentions of Iran vis-a-vis developing a nuclear weapon.
Well, Peter B., it's a long story, but I'll try to make it quite brief here. When you look for authoritative statements on an issue of this importance, you would look, well, let's say, to the Secretary of Defense, maybe, or to the Defense Secretary in Israel. So what have they said? Well, both of them have said within the last couple of weeks, Iran has not yet decided to build a nuclear weapon. Both of them said that, okay? Now, what do the intelligence agencies say on both sides? Well, I'm very proud to say that my former colleagues on the analytics side of the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community spoke out very bravely while George Bush was still in power in November of 2007 and concluded that whereas Iran did have a nuclear weapons program in being up until the end of 2003, they stopped it, and there was no evidence that they had reinstated it, and that's the case today. That's how the 16 agencies involved in intelligence in the United States, that's their judgment, even as recently as April of this past year when the last formal testimony was given to Congress. The Mossad, the external intelligence agencies of Israel, apparently says the same thing because that's what the defense minister said in preparation for the visit last Thursday of our chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey.
Dempsey, right.
So there you have it. You know, if the Israelis and Secretary Panetta said on Face the Nation, are the Iranians working to build a nuclear weapon? No. Now, that's pretty definitive, it seems to me. Now, the problem is that if you read what I call the fawning corporate media, the FCM, actually, it's a...
Have you trademarked that? That's a good one.
Well, yeah, it's better still when you realize that it's an acronym. But I won't go into that on the air. It requires a hard C in pronunciation. Indicates how I feel about them. Anyhow, getting away from that.
But you know what, Ray? We are liberated from the FCC's sanitization. So you can actually say fucking corporate media, and we won't draw a $350,000 fine.
Well, it's actually it's not what you said. It's the appellation that I would say under my breath, and it's just the three letters all together with a hard C.
Okay, like fuck 'em.
Yeah, you got it. But, I don't want to be quoted by saying such terrible things, Peter B.
But you didn't deny it; you confirmed it, so I got you. Now, Ray, before we talk about the coverage of the FCM. I want to drill into a specific point that is a widespread disinformation notion that is embraced by virtually every public official in this country, and that is the mistaken statement, we cannot permit Iran to possess a nuclear weapon. I think that it's a phony notion, and I think that it leads to many false choices that put us on a path to... a similar replay of Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction in 2002-2003.
It's all of the same piece, yeah. Here's Panetta, on Face the Nation. He said, no, they're not building a nuclear weapon, but when they build a nuclear weapon, watch out, because that's a red line for us. Well, what does it really mean? That means that just as Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, right? Then we build this consensus among the pundits and the fawning corporate media saying, oh, Iran must be working on a nuclear weapon because everybody says it is. When push comes to shove, and Obama and Panetta want to sort of tamp down the rhetoric, want to keep things under control so the Iranians don't do something stupid, or worse still, the Israelis don't do something stupid like provoking the Iranians and the Persian Gulf, then they say the truth, okay? So it is, it's the same kind of motivation as before Iraq. And you know what, Peter B., what really grapes me, it's the same people.
Yeah.
It's the same pundits. It's the same irresponsible, biased pundits that the New York Times hired to pass all this propaganda about what a threat Iraq was. So, while I think of it, I could deduce another parallel here.
Please.
In 2001, February, so before 9/11,
right.
Colin Powell said, is Iraq a threat to us? No. It has never been a threat, will not be a threat. It's not working on any weapons of mass destruction. July 29th, 2001, Condoleezza Rice said pretty much the same thing. We have been able to keep Saddam Hussein's arms from him. He's not even a threat to his immediate neighbors. Now, there you have true statements, okay? Then what happened? Well, 6 weeks after Condoleezza Rice said that, there was 9/11. Now, as you and I both know, because we've heard it 100 times, after 9/11, finish the sentence, Peter B., everything changed, right?
Yes, and irony was eliminated.
and we were asked to believe that whereas 6 weeks before 9/11, Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, was not a threat to anybody, all of a sudden, weapons of destruction have drifted down, wafting from the skies for a soft landing on the sands of Iraq, like manna from heaven, the sands in Iraq covering the oil that really belongs to us. Now, it was that crass, okay? But the American people were in shock. They had a nervous breakdown. They were pliable. And the question today is, were they still as naive? Were they still as willing to be led by people repeating untruths time and time again as if they were true? I think maybe, well, it's it's hard to decipher that from the Republican candidates' campaign, but I see even today. Here's the New York Times today. The piece that I wrote that you referred to was pretty much a rundown of everything the New York Times has said since General Dempsey appeared in Tel Aviv and the defense minister in Israel said, no, the Iranians had not decided to do a nuclear weapon. No, there's not going to be any strike on Iran anytime soon. No, they haven't decided. Okay, that's what Ehud Barak said. Now, every day since then, the Times has been beating the drums in the same manner. Now, here's today. I just looked it up on my little thing here. Middle East, New York Times, article, sanctions against Iran grow tighter, comma, but what's the next step? Piece by Helene Cooper. Okay. And what does she say about motivation here? Well, she says, settling for an Iranian state, okay, as though the United States is empowered to settle for this or that in the rest of the world, but U.S. settling for an Iranian state that could quickly produce a nuclear weapon would be hard for the United States to embrace because of Israel's deep antipathy toward Iran. Wait a second now. It's going to be hard for the United States to embrace because of Israel's deep antipathy toward Iran. So if the Israelis antipathize another country, we've got to embrace that kind of antipathy? Give me a break. You know, there it is, right out in black and white. Mm-hmm. This is the reason. This is the motivation. And, you know, the notion that if Iran got one nuclear weapon, it posed a threat to Israel with 200 or 300. I forget what the latest count is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the best person that addressed that was Jacques Chirac, the former president of France. He was asked this question, and he says, "Well, you know, if the Iranians put up one missile up in the direction of Israel." That would get maybe 150 meters in the air before Tehran was reduced to ashes. Okay? It's preposterous, he said. And of course, he's right. Why would the Iranians want to commit suicide by firing a nuclear weapon or any other kind of weapon at Israel, being sure of immediate retaliation, something that most Israeli leaders would dearly welcome a chance to do? So there is a deterrence now. There is a kind of understanding that unless someone can prove that Iran is a threat to Israel, then it will look bad to the rest of the world if the Israelis try to take out their nuclear facilities.
At least it's mini-MAD, right? It's mutual assured destruction on some scale if Iran did launch a first strike.
Yeah. The way I come at it, Peter B., is simply this, that sane Israelis will realize that since deterrence worked for 40-plus years during the Cold War, it could work here as well. So what are they, you know, in terms of the mechanics here, the military requirements, what are they really afraid of? Well, lately, two high Israeli officials have spoken out and explaining something that I had suspected all along. And they said, look, even if they got just one or two nuclear weapons, and we decided that we needed to do something in Lebanon or in Gaza or in Syria, we wouldn't have free rein to do that. We'd always have to look over our shoulders and see if the Iranians, even if they were bluffing, if they had a nuclear weapon, said, well, you really oughtn't to do that. You know, we don't like you beating up on our friends the Syrians. Then the strategic equation would be slightly altered to our detriment because we could never be quite sure that that the Iranians would be crazy enough to try something like that. So there is a certain deterrence, what I'd call a mini-deterrence, that would accrue to the Iranians were they to get just one or two weapons, even though it's not a strategic threat in a real sense to Israel. It would be a, a kind of geopolitical high card with the Israelis to wish to obliterate this, Lebanon again, or Gaza, or the, do some bad stuff against Syria or, mm-hmm. or the West Bank. So in that sense, it's judged to be a threat. But the most important thing is simply that Iran is the only plausible rival to Israel in that part of the world. Iran does have lots of assets in places like Lebanon and Hamas, of course, in Gaza,
mm-hmm.
and also in Syria. And so the Israelis would very much like to do in the mullahs and have some sort of regime change. And they've said this in their public documents. The fly in the ointment is, as Helene Cooper says in Today's Times, settling for an Iranian state that could quickly produce a nuclear weapon would be hard for the United States to embrace because of Israel's deep antipathy toward Iran. Well, there it is, we should not be, George Washington, our first president, warned against the passionate attachments to the designs of other countries as though they were identical with our own strategic objectives. He was absolutely right. And the sooner we tell the Israelis, look, we'd like to have everybody get along in the Middle East, we're not going to do your dirty work for you, and we're certainly not going to jump in if you provoke a war with Iran, then things would be a lot better. Now, what I've been saying all along is that Barack Obama has the power to put an end to all this foolishness, okay? All he need do is get up and make a speech and say, look, we're really concerned about what might break out in the Middle East there, particularly in the Persian Gulf area, and we want everyone to know that whoever provokes an incident that would lead to real fighting, real hostilities, we're not going to be in there in a knee-jerk faction supporting one country over another. We have no alliances in that part of the world. I'll say that again. We have no alliances in that part of the world. Now, I'm sure many of your listeners are saying, well, wait a second, Israel is our ally. Well, you know what? Israel is not our ally. Look it up in Webster. To be an ally of another country is to have a mutual defense agreement with it. There is no mutual defense treaty with Israel between Israel and the United States. Now, that's not for want of trying. Way back in the 70s, when there was the oil crisis and the embargo and all that stuff, and actually the Egyptians did attack Israel in 73, okay,
mm-hmm.
What did Kissinger and those people figure out? Well, they said, hey, maybe the best solution here is to offer a mutual defense treaty to Israel. People will think twice about attacking Israel if we were Israel's ally. So let's broach that. You know what? They did. You know what the Israelis said? Well, thanks. Thanks for the thought. That's very kind of you, but we're not interested. Now, why were they not interested? Number one, mutual defense treaties require internationally recognized boundaries, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Israelis were not going to put up with anything that challenged their territorial...
expansionism?
Yeah. And number two, who needs a treaty when you're pretty much sure that the United States is going to knee-jerk react in favor of you, or at worst, not say anything about what you might do in Lebanon or Gaza or anywhere else? And you don't want to be hemmed in. In other words, if you have a defense treaty with another country, it's sort of de rigueur that if you're going to attack another country, you usually say, well, hey, we're going to attack country X. I would just want to let you know because, we might get involved in a war here and you're our ally. Okay?
Yeah, uh-huh.
The Israelis, they want that. They don't want that stuff. They want to be able to do what they want to do. And the last thing, of course, is that they knew depend on the strongest lobby, the strongest foreign affairs lobby in this country, called AIPAC,
yep.
To do their bidding. So, that's the situation. That's why I think it's very important for Americans to realize that there is no mutual defense treaty with Israel, and that's because the Israelis preferred not to have it. Now, the wags or the funny people say, jokingly, they say, well, actually, Israel is offered to become a 51st state. And the question is, well, why did they say no? Well, they turned it down because then they'd only have two senators.
You got me with that one, Ray. Now let's turn our eyes toward the New York Times, which is now largely owned by the richest man in Mexico, Carlos Slim. He doesn't have any known treaties with Israel, and to my knowledge, is not a member of AIPAC. In fact, he's of Lebanese ancestry. With that sidebar, the Times has been beating the drum from around the world, really orchestrating correspondence in Paris, in Beijing, the chief correspondent in both Jerusalem and Washington have all been really singing the same song, which is not based on the very facts that you cited at the outset of this interview, coming from well-placed, credible sources like the Pentagon and the Israeli Defense Ministry. So talk a little bit about the way the Times has really departed from a factual basis to continue to fuel the fears of Iran and to stoke the whole idea that we must do something, and probably now.
Yeah, well, the Times is as everyone knows, very pro-Israel. And they pretty much take their cue from what the Israelis really would like to have here. The Israelis would like to really bash the Iranians so that there would be no real rival in that part of the Middle East. And the Times is a reflection of all that. Jill Abramson, who is now the executive director of the Times, she had a little, it was a gathering in their fancy new theater for Daniel Ellsberg on the 30th anniversary of the Pentagon Papers, okay? And Dan asked me to come along. And the word came through that, hey, there's going to be a Q&A. So I jumped up to the microphone. and yeah, it's a big
That's
theater.
Catnip for McGovern.
I said, there's a big question about whether Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon. Your newspaper never mentions the estimate that was prepared in November of 2007, which says they'd stop as of 2003. Now, there's a new director of intelligence coming in, and my friends have been very staunch in saying what they believe to be the case, that Iran still has not restarted creating a nuclear weapon. What happens if the new director, his name is Clapper, and he's much better than I thought, what happens if Clapper comes in and says, all right, we're going to change the line here. We're going to say that Iran is out for a nuclear weapon, just like we shaved the evidence on Iraq. We'll do it now on Iran. What should I tell my former colleagues? Should they go to the New York Times or should they go to WikiLeaks? Bearing in mind that when James Risen found out that George Bush and his administration were illegally eavesdropping on U.S. citizens 3 months before the 2004 election, the New York Times sat on that for 15 months.
Yeah.
So should I tell them to go to New York Times or, well, she danced away from that, okay? He said, well, Dan, you're an intelligence analyst. Why don't you answer that? She's very clever, okay? But the idea is that they know what the score is. They filled up a whole page. I'm down in Florida now. I was reading New York Times on a plane. I looked up page A8 of Saturday's paper. All got these stories from everywhere, from Beijing, as you mentioned, all these correspondents. The whole page was all Iran, Iran, Iran.
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, and so, that's really... it's a sign of the times. I'm down here in Florida, where the representatives have great influence, including the woman who's head of the House of Foreign Affairs, Elena Rosleitnen, the House of Affairs thing. And they make no bones about having as much loyalty, really, as much interest in Israel as they do in the United States. And when I saw President Obama last night, doing the the obligatory nod, saying, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, we're going to not allow that and all that kind of stuff. Well, give me a break, you know. His defense secretary just said, they're not. And so why do you make a big thing out of it? Well, we know the political reasons for it. Problem is, they could lead, as the Chinese say, this could have a no good end.
Yeah. Now, let me come back to the president in a moment, but one more item on the Times. The public editor, Brisbane, Arthur Brisbane, to his credit, has been raising important questions about whether the Times should challenge blatant lies that come out of the mouths, for example, of Republican candidates for president. And there's a discussion about it. that's what's really tragic here, is they're saying, well, you know, Keller, Jill Keller says, well, or do I have her name right?
Jill Abramson.
Jill Abramson. I'm sorry. Bill Keller was her predecessor.
Right.
She said, well, we don't want to be tendentious. So Newt Gingrich can just tell a bald-faced lie. It will be stenographically recorded by the New York Times, who might in a sidebar suggest that it possibly is untrue. But will they actually say the facts are otherwise, or just say the candidate appeared to be lying? No, they will not do that.
Not if it's on this issue. Yeah. And that's, you know, the New York Times used to be something you could rely on as a newspaper of record. It's very sad, actually. I'm from New York, and my parents would never go to bed at night without having read the New York Times. As my Irish grandfather would always say, I read it black and white. So, you know, it's hard to see this thing happen. There it is. Take Rick Santorum, for example.
Mm-hmm.
On the 1st of January, he has this this interview with that fellow from Meet the Press, NBC, David Gregory.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know what I'd do about Iran? I'd tell him, look, you open up your sites, you let the inspectors in there to do their job, or else. And Gregory looks at him and says, oh, wow, okay. And they go on to the next question. Now, I don't know what percentage of the American people know that the UN weapons inspectors are crawling over every nook and cranny in Iran even as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
But David Gregory, to keep his job in the fawning corporate media, doesn't even say, well, Santorum, isn't it the case that there are already inspectors there? He doesn't even say that.
Well, and Ray, in these what passes for debates with the Republican presidential candidates, the questions are lobbed at them, and then we just let the cameras roll as we watch how they respond. But whether it's John King getting bashed by Newt Gingrich for the inconvenient question about the ex-wife and open marriage and all that stuff, or it's the detached from reality statements that they make about Iran. You know, they say, well, we need more covert operations. Stuxnet, the killing of or attempted killing of now four of Iran's nuclear scientists, the most recent in broad daylight. Now, we don't know if that's U.S. Covert operation or Israeli, but you know we're in on it the same way that we share policies with Israel and follow their lead. And so the way they allow these guys to make statements that are not tethered to reality or coherent thinking in any way, and then just move on to the next question. It's much more like the World Wrestling Federation than any kind of journalism that we used to find in this country.
Yeah, I've learned a lot about this, Peter B. I didn't used to be in this business, but Bob Perry, for whom I work at ConsortiumNews.com, he's the paragon of virtue in this area. He uncovered the Iran-Contra affair,
right.
Pinpointed Ali North, and received great accolades for that. Moved from AP to Newsweek. And let me tell you a little story, which is very indicative about the situation with respect to the atmosphere in the press. Here is Bob Perry, hero for unveiling all these secrets, and he's at Newsweek now, and they're going to have a big soiree at Kay Graham's house there in Washington. They have corporate come down from New York, and Newsweek, Washington Post are all there, and he's sitting next to the executive director, and he's the youngest and newest guy there. And so it was a pretty interesting group. There was a young representative from Wyoming named Cheney.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
And there was Brent Scowcroft there, who was had just stopped being the National Security Advisor, and so forth. So the discussion starts talking about what John Poindexter, who took Scowcroft's place as National Security Director, what he should say when he testifies to Congress the next Monday about how much he told Ronald Reagan about what was going on in trading arms for hostages, okay? So Bob is having a shrimp cocktail, enjoying it, and someone says, well, how about that, General Scowcroft? How would you advise Poindexter? And Scowcroft says, well, I would certainly tell him to tell the Congress that he hadn't told the president anything. Well, Bob drops his fork, you know, not used to this kind of crassness, and without thinking, he says, well, General, do you mean to say you would advise Admiral Poindexter to commit perjury? Okay, that was how silent it was for about 30 seconds.
And, so then, finally, and then Kay Graham said, Miss Manners is here to talk to you, Bob.
No, worse still. The head of Newsweek puts his arm around Bob and says, now, Bob, sometimes you have to do what's best for the country. And all these gentlemanly laugh. And Kay Graham, well, that's it, right there. They know what's best for the country,
yeah.
And that's what they'll say, even if it means perjuring him. And Scowcroft, God, he's one of the good guys. So there you go. You know, that's how corrupt things have gotten. Let me just finish with this story about Santorum. You know, I thought that was dead. That was so egregious. That was like George Bush saying that the reason he attacked Iraq because they wouldn't let the UN inspectors in when they were crawling all over Iraq when he attacked them, okay? So what happens? 17 days later, on the 18th of January, just last week, Margaret Warner introduces her segment of the News Hour, PBS,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
What does she use as the clip? Rick Santorum saying, you better open up those sites in Iran. You better let inspectors go in there without any comment at all. Even though for the previous 2 weeks, everybody and his brother was writing to MSNBC saying, hey, guys, guess what? There are inspectors in Iran already. So that's how bad it is. They know what they're doing. They're marching to a drummer that keeps them paid, keeps them famous, keeps them coiffed, and like David Gregory, keeps them safe and sound.
With a seven-figure income in Gregory's case.
Yeah.
And Ray, I share your I can't turn deplore into a verbal. I share the way you deplore the coverage on PBS, because I watch it every night. I put it on TiVo, and it, to me, is the television broadcast, news broadcast, that is the best, and that's not saying much in American journalism today. But I get so frustrated because, as you point out, the talking heads that they recruited for this conversation about Iran were Vali Nasr and Dennis Ross. So we had a conservative, and we balanced that with a neoconservative. And there was no expression of caution. There was nobody there to say, you know, Iran and Iraq are more different than just the last letter in the names of their countries. And that if we attack Iran, it would be a very different calculation and response than what has happened, albeit tragically, in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And so the News Hour is so frustrating in that way, because they color always inside the lines of the Beltway and only occasionally allow a Phyllis Bennis, or when was the last time Ray McGovern was invited on the News Hour?
Well, it was about 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
My brother wrote me from New York this morning and said, you know, Margaret Warner, she'll remember you, right? She'll remember you from that thing. So you ought to send your article to her.
Uh-huh.
And I checked that out with Bob Parry, and he said, Ray, you know, it's not going to make any difference. What we need to do is create an alternative media. That's why I'm so glad to be able to talk to someone like you and to work for somebody like Bob Parry. Let me give you another little personal insight here. When I faced Rumsfeld mm-hmm. 5.5 years ago there in Atlanta,
right.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
as I was coming out of there, the phone rang, my little cell phone, and
This is Anderson Cooper. Mr. McGovern, you're creating quite a stir down here in Atlanta. I'd like to interview you, but first I want to ask you this. Weren't you scared?
Now, you know, I was in shock from what happened, and I said, well, that's a understandable question. And I said, well, no, I really wasn't. And then I thought, my God, this guy's heir to a fortune. He's a pretty boy. He's not gonna be out begging or in some homeless shelter. And so I decided to have some fun. I said, actually, you know, Anderson, it was a real high. I mean, I had done my homework. I knew he'd probably either have to lie or report. And so, you might want to try it, Anderson. Do your homework. Ask him some real questions. You'll find it's a real high.
well, let's get on with the interview here.
And some of that survived. It was broadcasted. He said, "Weren't you afraid?" So, well, but not my answer.
Ray, before we wrap up here, I wanted to get quick comments from you on two matters. One is that just the other day, a former CIA officer who ran the counterintelligence efforts in Pakistan, John Kiriakou, was indicted, and he is being prosecuted for revealing that Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded. And I want to get your comments on this because this makes the sixth prosecution of a whistleblower by the Obama administration, which sets a new record for the president who claims to be the most transparent president ever.
Yeah, this is the sign of the times here. Thomas Drake, the fellow from NSA, was accused of espionage, going to be sent away for 30 years. The judge who finally ruled on that case said that the government should be terribly embarrassed by the lack of credibility, the evidence they put up. He was exonerated on all counts except one, which was improper use of a government computer.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what the case is against Kiriakou. I remember him as being one of the interrogator types in Iraq, and apparently he's accused of divulging some names. There is a law. I mean, when people talk about violating the law by leaking, there's no Official Secrets Act in this country, so you don't violate a law by passing classified information unless it pertains to nuclear secrets, intercepted communications, or the identities of undercover agents. Okay, those are the three that there are laws against. So if they claim that this fellow leaked the names of some of these interrogators, and they have a case on that, at least they have some sort of legal basis to proceed on.
But Ray, these events occurred during the Bush administration and were not prosecuted then. And Obama has famously said on all crimes that may have occurred under Bush that he's looking forward, not backward. Why all of a sudden did they polish up the rearview mirror for Kiriakou?
Well, I'm afraid, and this may shock you, I'm afraid that President Obama is himself afraid of the CIA. Why else would he pick as his chief CIA advisor in the White House John Brennan, a fellow famous for rendition, for torture, and that kind of thing? Why else would he leave the perpetrators of these crimes, war crimes really, in being when he came into office? I think that Obama has read the book on the JFK assassination, the book by James Douglas, two S's on Douglas. The name is JFK and the Unspeakable. I can hardly believe myself saying this, but I did read the book twice very carefully, and I think that James Douglas has it right. It was Alan Dulles, some elements of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, some elements of the FBI and the Secret Service that did John Kennedy in and reversed the course of history for us all. Now, if Obama's read that book, he has reason to be afraid. And the way he has kowtowed not only to the CIA agents and so forth, but to the military, suggests to me that his priority is remaining alive, remaining the President of the United States, and he's going to do whatever he thinks will appease these people. These people want to to make sure that a fellow like Kiriakou does not divulge the identities of people who are torturing people. That's, you know, there's supposed to be certain honor among thieves, right? If you're one of the torturers or interrogators, you're not supposed to rat on your colleagues. And so it's a very vindictive thing, and of course, most of all, it's a warning to anybody else who wants to speak out and to expose these kinds of abuses. They're not supposed to, because they better not, because they'll get it in the end. That's what it's all about, and that worries me greatly, because never before have I seen this kind of a power, this kind of power, aggrandized or collected at the highest councils of our government. Barack Obama is not up to it. The generals and the intelligence types are, and he works within very severe constraints. I wish he had more guts, because I think as president, he could make himself, he could make his weight felt, but he doesn't have that kind of, backbone.
Yeah. And finally, Ray, it's pretty much the same problem, but just a different symptom. The president signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which includes the Homeland Battlefield Act, which permits the unlimited detention without trial or charge of an American citizen, even at a military base under U.S. military control. And your former colleague at CIA, Phil Giraldi, published a piece that I have up on my screen in front of me. And there is now a resolution in the House of Representatives that, when linked to this new authority under the NDAA, could ensnare you, because the resolution is to direct the Secretary of State to essentially declare that those who organized or were part of the recent Gaza flotilla this past summer should be designated as a foreign terrorist organization. And with that step, you would then be a covered person under the Homeland Battlefield Act, because you put yourself on one of those boats intending to go to Gaza last summer. And I'm linked to you because I spent $20 and bought a T-shirt called The Audacity of Hope, and some of my money went to fund the flotilla that you were a party to. So it looks like you and I could be, and this is not hyperbole or exaggeration, but we could be ensnared under this new law if Congress passes this resolution, and there's no doubt they will.
Well, there is some doubt that they will, but the point is still the same. I was tempted just now, Peter B., quite honestly, to make a joke of this, but this is, as my old Russian teacher used to say, this is nothing to laugh, okay? This is nothing to laugh. This is really serious stuff. And among all the things that have disappointed me about President Obama, this has to be on the top of the list. This reverses the rights for which our founders fought, for which our founders pledged their sacred fortunes as well as their lives and their honor. Okay, when they did that, it was far from certain that they would avoid dangling from the end of a rope, but they did it anyway. They gave us the Bill of Rights. Now, that goes back. This kind of thing goes back not only to 1787 or whenever, but to 1215, when those gutsy English barons faced down King John and said, look, no longer will we allow you to pick up one of us or one of these peasants, put him in jail without habeas corpus, without the right for this person, whoever he or she is, to appear before a court and face the charges of which they're accused. Now, that's 1215, okay? Every civilized government since then has adopted one form or another of habeas corpus. This reverses that. It reverses three of the Bill of Rights, parts of the Constitution itself. It is incredible, and Obama signed it. So, yeah, he has the power now to do precisely what you said. You were giving material support to the enemy, Peter B., by purchasing one of those shirts.
Yeah.
And if people think they need an empirical example of this, there are young people in Chicago and in Minneapolis, Catholic workers, Quakers, other anti-war types, who are being tried on felony charges of giving material support to the enemy by virtue of their meeting and trying to do anti-war activity. So, you know, people need to know this, and that's the big thing. The foreign and corporate media are keeping this from American people, but it's legal now for me, who served in this army, to be picked up by the people I used to command and be brought to Guantanamo without so much as a by your leave to my wife, kept there, and you know, seen ADA as the, without any, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And it's right in the bill there. So yeah, this is people need to know this, and the problem is that since Obama is not a Republican, the normal people who would be up in arms about this, for some reason, they're able to square with their conscience being relatively silent on this.
Ray McGovern, you're not, and I thank you for it.
Well, I thank you for your part in all this, Peter B., and I wish you good luck.
Ray McGovern, visit his new website, RaymondMcGovern.com. Thank you, Ray.
Right. Bye now.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. That is the theme from Shaft, from the late Isaac Hayes. And when I think about people who've really gotten the shaft, at the top of my list, it is the men who languish, uncharged, untried, and cleared for release at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But they live in limbo. And the president doesn't have the political juice or apparently the political will to stand up for justice and find a reasonable way to release those who will not be charged or tried and who are not accused of any serious acts of terrorism. Nancy Tulanian joins us on the program today. She is the founder of the nonprofit No More Guantanamos on the web at nogitmos.org. Nancy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
And first, a little bit of history. I connected with you through Shahid Buttar, who has taken your place. You were the founding director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And I think it's a great organization fighting important struggles on our behalf. And I'd like you to take a moment here before we talk about the contemporary issues of Guantanamo to talk about the original Bill of Rights or local defense committee that you set up that expanded into this national organization fighting for the civil rights that are embedded in the Constitution.
Well, when the Patriot Act passed by a huge majority, we were concerned in our community that we could be spied on with the help of our own police force, et cetera, as the FBI was doing, picking up Arab and Muslim men around the country without any evidence of wrongdoing. So we decided that we would do some public education and pass a resolution upholding our constitutional rights, the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights. And we did that. Local communities nearby, Northampton, Amherst, and Leverett did the same. And I just publicized it, got news out to the rest of the country, and gradually people started coming to the website. So we ended up with more than 400 resolutions, including the whole state of California and seven other states doing the same to go against what Congress had done by a huge majority and wasn't about to undo by saying, well, we're not going to allow this in our community.
And to what extent did you believe the campaign promises of President Obama that he would close Guantanamo?
Well, actually, I did believe it initially, and that was the impetus for No More Guantanamos. The name means not just Guantanamo, but Bagram and other places around the world where people are being held. But
indeed.
We thought that, of course, it would be difficult because the American public didn't really know the story of Guantanamo and how people ended up there, sold for bounties and so on, most of them innocent. So we thought we would do public education similar to the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, community by community, having each one take the story of one or two detainees so that people could see the real story and not what they'd been told about the worst of the worst. And then Obama let us down. Congress made it worse. And so, as usual, the American people have to carry the ball if
yeah.
they want justice.
And, Nancy, I mentioned this to you before we started this recorded conversation, but I look at the parallel. On day one of his presidency, Bill Clinton, with a flourish, said, I'm going to allow gays to serve openly in the military. And it was one of his own Democratic Party members, Sam Nunn, the powerful senator from Georgia, who led the charge to block that. It took 18 years to rectify that misstep, as well-intentioned as Bill Clinton was. And the same, I'm sorry to say, appears to hold for President Obama and his pledge to close Guantanamo, that he didn't count the votes, he didn't check with members of his own party's leadership. And Harry Reid, the Senate Democratic leader from Nevada, has been one of the staunchest people who helped block the move to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a federal court in New York, and who has led the charge to tie the president's hands by passing legislation that, you know, essentially requires that Guantanamo or a place like it be available because the Congress has limited the president's ability to hold and try so-called terrorism suspects. And so I hope it doesn't take 18 years to recover from President Obama's day one error.
Well, unfortunately, if we look at that parallel, it may take more than 18 years, because in the case of the soldiers who were affected, they were U.S. citizens. They had representation in Congress. These people in Guantanamo and Bagram do not.
Yeah.
They don't have people in high places who are looking out for them. They only have us.
Well, and we know that there is no justice at Guantanamo. I've interviewed Colonel Morris Davis, who was at one point a lead prosecutor for the judge advocate generals for the military trials. And he resigned after he was told there shall be no acquittals. And so it is a kangaroo court. It is rigged. It's designed for political show trials. And even at that, there isn't much process, and we see that of the three dozen or so so-called high-value detainees who are accused of serious crimes, beyond that, there are, 140 or so individuals still at Guantanamo who have been cleared for release, but they are left in an Obama-imposed limbo.
That's right. We have at least 89 cleared for release. There is an additional number of Yemeni men who've done nothing wrong, but they're afraid to send them back to Yemen because of the lack of, shall we say, a government.
And there are about 50 Yemenis, is that right?
I think there are 90, actually.
Oh, 90.
So some they would send back if they were allowed to, and some they would say, well, we have to wait until we have some presence in Yemen that would make sure that they don't go astray. But anyway, it's a huge number. I mean, a large number who, as I mentioned, were sold for bounties by people who took the U.S. military offer sheets that fell out of planes,
mm-hmm.
offered them $5,000 or more dollars for turning over terrorists, and guess what? They made up stories to collect that money, which is a huge amount in Pakistan or Afghanistan.
Yes, indeed. And let's get specific about the Yemenis here, because these were people who were generally cleared before Obama took office. And so, for a three-year period, he was trying to place some of them, and there is a special envoy at the State Department whose job is to try to persuade other nations to take individuals who've been incarcerated at Guantanamo. And Yemen, I think, is a particular problem because we're engaged in an undeclared war there. And we claim that we don't have troops on the ground. I think we do have covert forces there. We use drone strikes against Yemen at will. And here is what is so bizarre, is we have extended to the bloody dictator who has ruled there for more than 30 years an invitation to come to the United States of America. And this, to me, replicates the pattern that happened when we accepted the Shah of Iran in the mid-1970s. And it did exacerbate the anger that Iranians had against the United States that surfaced in the hostage crisis and the Khomeini-led revolution. I don't know that this could be replicated in Yemen, but I'm very concerned about the signal it sends that innocent Yemenis can't go home and one who is very guilty is being invited to the United States.
Exactly. There was talk a year or so ago about the Yemenis setting up a program to so-called rehabilitate the Yemeni men who were being held in Guantanamo indefinitely, and they were looking for money to run this, and this seems to have fallen through the cracks. But if we want to make peace with these countries, and at one point I think the detainees came from, I don't know, hundreds of countries, but if we want to have peace in the world, we're not setting a very good example. And in places like Yemen, that's especially blatant that there are so many of their men still in Guantanamo, and we're doing nothing about it.
Yeah. And just this week, Navi Pillay, who is the United Nations Human Rights Chief, has issued a statement sharply critical of the United States government related to Guantanamo. Quote, "It is 10 years since the government opened the prison at Guantanamo and now 3 years since President Obama ordered its closure within 12 months. Yet the facility continues to exist and individuals remain arbitrarily detained indefinitely in clear breach of international law." Now, I consider that to be a significant indictment of the United States of America. It undermines the claims that play out on television that we're a nation of liberty and freedom, and that those are precious ideals and values that we project to the rest of the world. And to me, that is all fully negated by the very clear example that we set, the actions that we take that speak so much louder than all of those words.
Absolutely. She said very clearly, charge and prosecute or release them. And that's exactly what needs to happen. If they've done nothing wrong, they should go. There's Congress passing laws to make sure that nobody who's been cleared can go anywhere. And these people were cleared not just by Obama. They were cleared by senior officials representing every U.S. department of every department in our government that has any responsibility for protecting the country, including the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been a lot of wrist slaps. If you talk to people in most of the world, I'm sure, not just within the U.N., but most countries, they're probably close to unanimous that Guantanamo should be closed and these people should be treated by the ideals that we claim to hold up and are falling down on the job.
Nancy, how do you see a way out of this? How can we educate the American people and undo the propaganda that is burned into their minds from Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and his cronies, that only the worst of the worst went to Guantanamo, and that they don't even deserve due process, that we know they're bad, and therefore that's all there is to it?
Well, we've done several things in the communities that are part of our organization. One is to have local groups not only hold educational programs to tell the truth, but to tell the stories of actual people. Because if people don't relate to, say, how this happened, that Guantanamo is so far from our ideals, they can relate to human stories. Here's a man, he has this family, he was picked up at the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan when he was sold for a bounty by greedy Pakistani soldiers or what have you. And you know, he's a Russian ballet dancer who was there trying to find a safe place for his family to relocate, and he's been there for 10 years. He's been cleared by a federal judge who found that the government had no cause to hold him, and still he can't leave. And people kind of relate to that. in Amherst, where we passed a resolution to welcome a few cleared detainees, the first in the country. The latest was Berkeley, California, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We first went to the select board of the town and got one more vote than we expected, which put us over the top. And what this woman said before she voted yes, she said, "I came to this meeting prepared to vote no, but then I read the information that was provided, and it contained stories of two prisoners that you'd like to take out of Guantanamo and settle in Amherst." And she said, "I realized that I've been fed propaganda, and I've decided to change my vote to yes." She supported the resolution. So then we got press, and it passed, and the rest I wish were history, not quite history, but at least it was. It showed that the stories can make a difference to people who don't get it otherwise.
Well, I appreciate that you have the patience and the persistence to take it on at that level. My take on it is that, unfortunately, the fear-based messages are so deeply embedded in the American psyche, and that Hollywood doesn't help. You know, the Jack Bauer and 24 is fictional, but it crosses the line into reality in enough people's minds that they're in a kind of denial. They don't want to know about the individual stories of people at Guantanamo. They are content to be told that it's where the worst of the worst are, and you don't have to worry your pretty little head about it. And, you know, politically, we've seen that since Obama was brushed back by political leaders, including many in his own party, that there is a generalized silence. The media doesn't care to investigate issues related to Guantanamo for the most part. And our political leaders have gone generally silent, except when it pops up in a Republican debate and you hear Mitt Romney say he wants to double Gitmo and, you know, other kinds of real crazy talk. So it's very hard to put this back on a rational footing. Would you agree?
Definitely. And, well, another alternative method is what Americans are doing is way over the top, torturing people, using prison informants, etc. What if these were our guys? Our soldiers were treated this way by other governments. I mean, what's to stop them if the American government says it can do this to their people? And how would they feel about that? This is why we set up the Geneva Conventions in the first place. If you don't want your soldiers to be tortured, then don't torture theirs. And, treat people with human rights and so on.
Well, and there's at least a glimmer of hope. We're speaking the day after it's a unanimous decision, but there were two opinions written by the Supreme Court honoring, for a change, our Fourth Amendment rights related to the use of GPS tracking devices that were secretly placed on the cars of suspects. And it appears that in the oral arguments, Chief Justice Roberts was appalled to learn that they could do it to him. And so, you know, maybe we need to project this into the laps of the Supreme Court justices and say that this could happen to you. And under the National Defense Authorization Act and the so-called Homeland Battlefield language that is a part of that bill that the president signed on December 31st, Americans, probably not a Supreme Court justice, but Americans accused of terrorism could get the full Gitmo treatment. And yet I've tried every way I can to alert people and get them to an appreciative level of alarm. And for the most part, people yawn and say, "Well, it's not going to affect me, man. I'm not worried."
Yeah, it is kind of scary that, one thing that did come up was the National Defense Authorization Act, and people were going nuts over the idea that Americans could be rounded up and held without charge. Well, it turns out I think Congress removed that, but the idea that we can do that to anybody else is kind of appalling to me. If it's too horrible to do to Americans, then why should we do it to anybody else and expect them not to do it to us?
Mm-hmm. Well, but that's where the myth of American exceptionalism comes in. And again, the Republican candidates invoke this quite a bit in their debates in the primary states, that we're special and that we're above the law. And, for example, to its credit, Fox News actually asked the question about the NDAA and forced the Republican candidates to take a position. It was the first surprise for me in watching Rick Santorum, that he piped up and said he opposes it. But by and large, we have people playing to a mob mentality, and it's very hard to reason with that mob.
You bet it is. We definitely have our work cut out for us. We've had Cheney and his ilk saying they're the worst of the worst, which has kind of stuck. You mentioned the television show, Fox Television Show 24. And on and on and on. And then there are the people who are against the UN, so Navi Pillay doesn't hold any weight with them. But you know, we feel we have no choice but to move on and try to get somewhere with the American people and convince our government that it's in their best interest to treat other human beings the way they expect to be treated.
Nancy, with the 171 people remaining there, I wonder if I can pick a name here and see if it works, see if you know about the case of Shaker Amer. But he's a British citizen who really became a leader of the prisoners at Guantanamo, and at least on the face of it, it appears that he is still being held there despite the repeated pleas of the British government. And it seems that they're selecting him for special punishment because he did seem to be a charismatic leader of the prisoners. Tell us a little bit more, at least to the extent you know, about Shaker Amer.
Well, one thing that has happened in other cases as well is those who have witnessed horrible crimes or those who have been tortured end up being held longer. And I don't know which of the two cases it is. In his case, Mwazambeg was held for years because he had witnessed a murder or two when he was at Bagram. And with Shaker Amer, he was actually treated to a form of torture that is believed to have been what killed the three so-called suicides back in
June of 2006.
2006, exactly. Mm-hmm. So if he was subjected to that, that may be the reason they're not letting him go. The story remains fairly quiet while mm-hmm. he is locked up.
Now, Nancy, I'm glad you mentioned the incident from 2006. Scott Horton of Harper's Magazine, who teaches law at Columbia, did a fabulous job of exposing those incidents. In a single night, three individuals were pulled out of the main camp. And guards can confirm that they left alive and they came back dead the next morning. And the story floated was that they had all, in a coordinated act of asymmetrical warfare, had stuffed cloth down their own throats and committed suicide in that manner. The facts don't really match, or the story doesn't match the underlying facts that Scott Horton was able to assemble. And yet the Obama Justice Department has, they claim, they have reviewed these three deaths and said that nothing out of the ordinary or nothing illegal occurred. Do we have any other crack at those cases and at really getting to the bottom of why those three men died?
Well, actually, there is a story. I wish I had the link to it in front of me, but about dry boarding, that the three men were subjected to a form of torture where they were their throats were stuffed, as you say, with cloths, and they probably choked to death. And it's believed that that's the same thing that that happened to Shaker Amer. And also to the man whose name I'm temporarily forgetting, who was held in the U.S. and was convicted back a few years ago.
You mean Padilla?
No, he was not a U.S. citizen.
Oh, okay.
He was a legal U.S. resident.
That's okay.
Forgotten it.
I can understand that. Well, how do you characterize the role of Eric Holder's Justice Department in dealing with these issues? After all, the order was given that we're looking forward, not backward, and I think that is a very clear call for obstruction of justice. But it has managed to hold, and because of the context that was created around these individuals and the way they have been demonized, the idea of upholding the rule of law and standards of objective investigation and prosecution, well, that takes a back seat to the fear-driven desire to keep us safe.
Well, this doesn't come as a surprise, having been at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and watching the likes of John Ashcroft create a Department of Injustice. Holder isn't quite nearly to that level, but still, it is frustrating to have to continue to see the government supporting the systems and even strengthening the systems that have kept us from having any justice, just simply because it doesn't dare to prosecute the torturers, those who put together the policies and violated the international laws that that now we as a nation seem to be upholding.
Mm-hmm. Nancy, I want to turn now to the prisons in Afghanistan, and the new facility at Bagram Air Force Base is the one that's best known to Americans, but Anand Gopal, the independent journalist, has reported that there are a number of black sites where individuals are held, often for a lengthy period of time without charge, under U.S. control in Afghanistan. Now, recently, Hamid Karzai, who I don't consider to be a legitimate leader, but he's what we've got in Kabul, Afghanistan, he has rankled his minders by having an investigation conducted that's embarrassing to the United States about who is at Guantanamo, who is being held at the Bagram prison, and under what basis and for how long. And fundamentally, President Obama, who claims to be the most transparent president in American history, has blocked even a basic visit from the International Red Cross to determine who is actually being held there. So this is the blackest of black sites in the American gulag at present. Is that fair to say?
I think it is, and it's been expanded. There are now, I believe, over 2,000 prisoners held in Bagram. And I know the International Justice Network has been working to represent these men, and it fought on behalf of bringing the writ of habeas corpus to the prisoners of Bagram, won at the lower court level, but lost because the Obama administration appealed. And the Court of Appeals upheld it, and the Supreme Court would not hear the case. So there are men there who were shipped there from other countries, picked up all over the world, and brought to Bagram. And
right.
The excuse for not allowing them the writ of habeas corpus to challenge their detentions is because, well, they're in a war zone, and it would be inconvenient for the military to have to do that. Well, then don't bring them to a war zone from all over the world is what I would suggest.
And why do you believe the American media turns a blind eye to this? It's widely known that we are importing detainees to Afghanistan so that we can hold them there with the excuse that you just offered, that we can't process a habeas writ in a war zone. And so this is a shell game.
Well, that's one area where there may be good news. Just before you called, I actually had read a story that the Obama administration is considering repatriating the Bagram prisoners who are from outside of Afghanistan. So we'll have to see when and if that happens, but at least it seems that somebody is mindful that this is wrong.
And forgive my cynicism, but that appears to be damage control in the of Karzai's repeated push to have these facilities turned over to Afghan control. And you know, I've got very mixed feelings about all this. I don't think we belong in Afghanistan in the first place, but I don't really trust the Karzai government. I would prefer to see a transparent operation by NATO of these prison facilities to get it out of exclusive U.S. control and hope to bring some international sunshine to A, who is held there, B, for what reasons, and C, how they will eventually be processed.
Absolutely a great idea. Of course, everything the U.S. government seems to do is to avoid embarrassment and, I guess, you know, covering things up, hiding things from the international community. Not that they're getting away with it, but that seems to be a motivating factor. But that is a great suggestion. I agree.
Well, and just a quick sidebar, a little less than a year ago at a social event in Detroit, I was introduced to a National Guard general. And I said, oh, what have you been up to? And he said, oh, I just got back from Bagram. I said, oh, yeah, what have you been doing? He said, well, I'm with the Corps of Engineers, and we just built a new prison at the Bagram facility. And at that point, I started to ask him about who was there and why, and suddenly his amnesia kicked in. And he said, well, I don't know much about that. I just built the place. And, you know, that's the kind of attitude. Now, he's a man with a job and probably has obligations in terms of a security clearance and that sort of thing. But, you know, it is a hot potato. And those who know are remaining silent. And I view this as similar to the Holocaust, where silence is really an expression of complicity.
You bet. Fortunately, not everyone is capable of remaining silent forever. And one of the sites that I'd like to point out to listeners is the Guantanamo Testimonials Project, which is at the UC Davis website. You can look that up online. There are quotes from guards who were at Guantanamo and former prisoners, lawyers, etc. So you can find all sorts of interesting information that way by guards who were at Guantanamo and realized that what they had to do was totally wrong, and they're spending their time and, well, in some cases, trying to make up for what they did.
Well, I have been fortunate to interview a couple of men who served there and are courageous enough, mostly because they've left the military, to speak out about what they experienced and how it affected them. And that's another critical factor. When we make people the gatekeepers and the minders for individuals being held in an unjust and subhuman way, it affects them. And, you know, there is a form of PTSD that I believe comes from that kind of duty.
Absolutely.
Nancy, Greg Craig, during the first year of the Obama presidency, was the White House counsel who was put in charge of closing Guantanamo. And while he's been very polite about it, he left the administration clearly very frustrated that he would not be able to complete that assignment. Have you heard anything that Greg Craig has gone public to talk about those frustrations and to try to find a different route to achieve closure of Guantanamo?
I haven't seen anything, I'm afraid. Maybe he's being a good soldier and keeping quiet to benefit the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he knows a lot, and maybe I'll send a note to Scott Horton and suggest that he approach Greg Craig and see if he can get him to talk, because I think that that could be a useful avenue to pursue. Nancy, what else would you like to say to our listeners in terms of your own mission to close Guantanamo and prevent a future prison of its kind from being created?
Well, I think I would love to hear from people listening. Please contact us at info@nogitmos.org and visit the website. We do have several affiliates and chapters, so if you're working on this issue, I'd love to work with you on it. to come up with as many ideas as we can to get the truth out there and to motivate people who are in positions to do the right thing. There is a petition, speaking of that, right now, a White House petition that we have listed on the front page of our website, nogitmos.org, that actually is part of the work of Andy Worthington, whom you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. and I urge people to sign it. They need to get, I believe, 25,000 signatures on it by February 6th, so that's coming up. So please do that and stay in touch, and let's share all the good ideas we can come up with, because unfortunately, as we've said repeatedly in this conversation, our so-called leaders need to have us to follow, because they're not doing the right thing.
Well, Nancy, thank you, and I do want to reference Andy Worthington's website. It has a complete list of the 771 individuals who were held at Guantanamo over the last 10 years, and it was updated following the WikiLeaks disclosures to provide a great deal of both confirmation and additional new information. It's andyworthington.co.uk, or just do an online search for Andy Worthington Guantanamo. Nancy Tulanian, thanks for the work you do, and really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Peter. I enjoyed our conversation.
When they are free, we shall be free.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.